Right, well, the background to what I want to argue today is the territory claimed by today's atheists, skeptics, and scoffers. They claim that science, logic, reason, rationality is their territory. Theirs, they say, is the scientific position. They say that they begin with no bias, no prejudice, or pre-commitments that are going to affect the outcome. They're just going to rationally evaluate the evidence offered for whatever belief is put before them. They contrast science with faith and proclaim themselves as the champions of evidence-based reasoning. On the other hand, believers in divine creation are biased, have a pre-commitment to belief in God. We cannot, they say, rationally evaluate the evidence, and we must make faith-based leaps. The creationist position is, according to these critics, fundamentally irrational. Well, this puts us rather on the back foot. You know, I'm a Christian. I do have pre-commitments. I am not open to any kind of conclusion or argument to every and any kind. Am I going to have to defend being closed-minded and irrational? Am I going to have to put up with being painted as some kind of cave-dwelling, anti-scientific leftover from a mythical dark age? How can we reply to these critics? Well, in this talk, I'm going to use a well-known acquaintance, Professor Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, Professor for the Public Understanding of Science. He did some years ago. I'm going to use him as a foil for some of the things which I'm going to be saying. So as some of you know, I have strong doubts that he actually exists. But we'll leave that to one side for the moment. I'm going to be using him and others like him to introduce a crowd that's sometimes called the village atheists. He's a flag bearer of a movement of popular level atheism. His books aren't aimed at those with philosophical training. Those who do have philosophical training have read them, have given him a bit of a hard time. And if you read his responses, he gets a bit touchy. But he's aiming at the man in the street. If you go on the internet and start debating these things, the kind of arguments that you'll hear, from the man in the street, a lot of them are very like, or they come from, the kind of arguments Richard Dawkins is making. So I'm going to, at various points in this talk, be more apparently dealing with the questions of God's existence, reality, rather than creation as such. But from the point of view I'm going to be defending, those two issues cannot be separated. I'm a Christian. In Christian thinking, the creator-creature distinction is absolutely essential to all authentic thinking about God. We can only know God as creatures knowing a creator. We cannot escape from creation and stand alongside him and know as he knows. We can only know in the ways in which he has chosen to reveal himself to creatures. There's no immediate knowledge of God available to us, except there is only that which is mediated into creation and received by us as creatures, receiving it from a creator. So what I'm saying is that the denial of creation is, to all intents and purposes, the denial of God. If nature can be explained, understood apart from the plan and activity of God, then there is no God anything like the way Christians claim there is. The triune God of the Bible cannot then be our maker and cannot then be our lawgiver, our sustainer, or our judge. If any God does exist, he would have to be a very, very different being. Just one more player in the world rather than one over it and greater than it and above it. A God somewhat more close to our own level, more manageable for those who don't like him. So the question of creation is really the question of God, put another way. So the title which I'm speaking with is phrased in something a defensive way. Can rational people believe in divine creation, or is it simply impossible? Do we get a seat at the table of discussion and debate, the seat at the table of logical and reasonable folk, or we just can't have to leave the whole lot to others? My intention, though, isn't really to defend, it's to attack. I want to throw everybody else off the table and claim the sole right to sit at it. As a Christian, I don't believe that Christianity is in such a poor position that it ought to be pleading to be allowed a seat at the table. I believe that the Lord Jesus is the sole rightful Lord of the universe, by whom and for whom it was made, and that all his enemies must bow to him. I believe that in banging the drum so much for science and rationalism, the atheist is making a lot of noise, but actually has very little of substance to say. When you look underneath the surface, there's a gaping hole in his position. I believe that the issues of rationalism and so on, far from being the disbeliever's strong cards, are his ruin. But in this lecture, I want to play off atheism against Christian theism and make the case that atheism is the very height of irrational thought. I want to argue that the atheist's decision to rely on science, logic, and reason is disastrous for him. If we ask probing questions about what logic is in an atheistic universe, we're going to discover that his cupboard is empty. I'm going to also bring in the argument from morality. Professor Dawkins argues that religion is responsible for disproportionate amounts of evil, and that the moral good of human society demands that rational people fight against religion. So, okay. Okay, here's a poster you can download from his website, and you can put it up to get the message out. There's the Twin Towers of the September the 11th attacks in New York. Imagine no religion. The message is clear. There was no religion, lots of innocent people would still be alive. Now, it's not my purpose today to show that Professor Dawkins uses lots of illogical and fallacious arguments, misrepresents Christian theism, and has given us so much material that logic tutors could spend a lifetime using his books as their textbooks for exposing logical fallacies. That's easy enough to do. I believe you had a speaker examining some of his books not so long ago, several books in print dissecting his arguments. If we were taking this poster apart, well, it's the so-called post hoc fallacy. That is, the terrorists behind 9/11 were motivated by religion, therefore religion is to blame. They say there's religion behind it, so religion is the cause. If I made the same poster and put imagine no Islam or imagine no Arabs, I imagine that people would start getting very hot under the collar and say that I was making gross generalisations and shouldn't be allowed to do such things. It doesn't need a genius to spot that this poster is assuming the thing that needs proving, that is, that there is no difference between true religion and false religion. We can just dump the whole lot in together. But I'm not going to spend time such looking at Dawkins' arguments so much as what lies behind them. My aim today is to tackle him and those like him on the subjects of logic and morality themselves. I did a post of my own. There's Stalin, 60 million or so, believed to have died under his reign. He was an atheist. Imagine no atheism, all those innocent people would still be alive. Bad arguments can be easily turned round. But what I'm going to argue today is that atheism has no credible explanation of the phenomena of logic and reason themselves, or morality or evil, that only Christian theism can give a coherent explanation of reality as it really is. I'm not going to talk anything about genes, no biology, no fossils, no rocks, no looking at the early history of the universe, no discussion of the book of Genesis. I'm going to be dealing with the philosophical issues and questions implied by the idea of divine creation as revealed to us in Genesis, and comparing it with the issues and questions in atheism, as defended by Dawkins and friends. So what I'm going to do is compare Christian theism with atheism. How do these two systems of thought compare when dealing with questions about rationality and morality? But I'm speaking to you from the viewpoint of Christian theism and hence Christian creationism. I'm not speaking about some generic, unbranded theism shared by lots of religions. No such theism exists. I'm going to be depending on specifically Christian ideas, such as creation in the image of God. I'm going to assume Christian ideas. Let me give you another example. Islam has a doctrine of creation, but it has no doctrine of the fall. It cannot give, I believe, a rational explanation for many phenomena that exist in the fallen world, the world that really is. So I'm going to, in my arguments, be accepting without question as my fundamental presupposition that the triune God revealed in Scripture is the God who really is. We've got to ask then the question, what is atheism? Maybe you thought the answer was obvious. In fact, atheists today are increasingly taking up a rather subtly altered definition to try and use in their debates with us. I think they're doing that because they realise that the old position is harder for them to defend. That position was that the existence of God could be definitely disproven. Now, I don't want to make generalisations. There's plenty of people using either definition. But the position which increasing numbers of them are taking up to defend is not that there is no God and that I can show you it, but that there is no proof for God. That they claim that all the proofs for God are inadequate and therefore we're atheists by default. Now, one great example you can find for this, if you go on the internet and search for the debate by Christian professors Greg Barnson and atheist professor Gordon Stein from the 1970s. Professor Stein begins by defining atheism in this way. By default, he says, we should be uncommitted. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, and we do not believe in a God because nobody has shown us that there is one. There might be a God, we just don't know yet. We don't have the reasons for believing it yet. Maybe somebody in the audience can fly. If you say you can fly, we're not going to believe it until you show us the proof that you can fly. If you don't start flying right now, that doesn't mean that you can't fly, it just means that you're not flying right now. Is there a God? Professor Stein said, we don't know. All we know is that the arguments used by believers in God are faulty, that none of the gods that they propose exist. And you'll see that Stein is really blurring the lines between atheism and agnosticism. So atheists who argue like this say that claims for God require proof. When that proof is offered, we test it with science, logic, reason. And in all cases, they say, we've done this and we find that the proofs fail. But we don't then say there is no God. We say the existence of God is not proved. The atheist will then make a case that God is unlikely. We can't prove a universal negative. You cannot do an entire sweep of the universe all in a single instant to discover that there wasn't some God hiding in a corner of it somewhere where you didn't search at that instant. But we can make a probability argument. And the atheist then throws up lots of difficult questions about suffering and evil and so on, and argues that it's really very unlikely. That's what Dawkins does. We cannot, of course, he says, disprove God just as we cannot disprove Thor, fairies, leprechauns and the flying spaghetti monster, who's somewhat of a favourite of atheists of his variety. But like those other fantasies that we can't disprove, we can say that God is very, very improbable. Atheists who argue this way sometimes sum up their position in the statement, atheism is the default. We hold an atheistic position until someone shows us that we can't, and as yet, nobody has. Maybe you think that the difference is very insignificant between those two positions. Professor Dawkins certainly lives as if it were an absolute certainty that there were no God. But in terms of the debate and the discussion of God's reality, the difference is a significant one. It is important not to allow the atheist to get away with it, because it is a debater's trick. When your opponent speaks like this, he's seeking to get the privileged position in your discussion. He's stacking the deck. He's shifting the burden. He's excusing himself the hard work of having to prove that atheism is actually true and placing the whole burden on you to prove that it isn't. In the debate over God and creation, though, it won't do. In the debate which we're discussing here, we have a totally comprehensive debate. It includes the entirety of reality, the whole universe of phenomena. The matters that must be explained, either in terms of creation or without creation, include everything that ever was or ever will be, whether it's physical, immaterial, theoretical. So now we're getting to the point. The matters which atheism or theism must give an account for include logic, reason, and the scientific method. What are they? Where do they come from? Are they really universal laws? If so, what is their source? Are they imposed by God upon his creation, top down? Or should they be explained as arising from the world, from the material world, bottom up? The conceptions of what is meant by morality, logic, and so on are going to be fundamentally different in an atheistic or a theistic universe. They can't be taken for granted. They cannot be explained. Not quite onto that one. The only proper way to deal with this question then is through comparing two alternative worldviews. We must never allow the atheist to declare that we must come together, sit on neutral territory, and then use logic and reason to process the evidence. Logic and reason are themselves part of what's at stake. They belong to Jesus Christ, according to the system I'm arguing for, and they can only be rightly understood in relation to him. According to the atheist, there's something else entirely. They are part of what we're fighting over. They are part of the battle of the worldviews. So what then is a worldview? I know some of you have read Nancy Piercy's excellent book, Total Truth. I recommend anybody who hasn't gets hold of it and starts going through it as quickly as they can. I badgered my wife for some time and eventually started reading it. And she said, I should have started reading this ages ago. It's an excellent introduction to the subject. Piercy explains that a worldview is an interpretative grid. It is a grid which we filter other claims to truth through. It's what we use to understand other things. It is the things which we consider as basic and essential, and which we take for granted and then assume from then on. It's the foundation on which we build everything else. Now, everybody has a worldview. Everybody is always making assumptions about reality. And very few people lie in bed in the morning and have a debate with themselves about whether the outside world exists this morning. They have certain assumptions lying in the back of their mind which lead them just to get out of bed and get on with it. The only real difference is that some people are more aware of their worldviews and that some people live more consistently with their worldviews. Maybe there's a very dear, sweet little granny next door who is doing all kinds of errands for everybody in the neighbourhood and looks after all the stray cats, but she says there's no God. And she says, and the logic of her worldview is that there's no God, no meaning, no good or evil, but she lives completely inconsistently with it. Maybe down the town there's somebody living in the gutter who lives as if there were no God, and they just do whatever pleases them, and if you annoy them, they do away with you. I mean, they're living consistently with their worldview. They both have them, but one of them's putting into practice rather better than the other. A worldview is the backstory of history. It's what's behind everything else. It's the big picture which we use to understand and explain all the rest of the details in the picture. Now, everybody has a worldview. Get talking to people and find out about why they do the things they do. Ask why, and you'll have to get an answer. Keep asking why, ask why, and you'll get back and back and back. Eventually all the explanations need to be traced to certain things which are not explained, but just assumed. They just are. It has to be that way, because otherwise you just have to argue round in a circle. One is true because of two is true because of three, and three is true because of one. And then it's just all hanging in midair. You have to have some things which you get back to and can't go back any further from. Some things must necessarily exist. They are self-existent. They are the things which we use to explain the other things, things which aren't self-existent. So now a worldview is an interpretative grid which we use to allow or disallow second-level arguments and explanations. The basic elements of the Christian worldview are the triune God as revealed in Scripture, and his works of creation, providence, that is his sustaining of the creation and everything in it and everything that happens in it, and redemption. Everything is seen through these spectacles. I'm not saying that Christians always see those things through these spectacles, but if they were being true to their worldview, then they would. We evaluate human actions in terms of God and whether the things being done please or displease him. We see history as under God's control and heading towards the revealing of Jesus Christ on the last day in glory. There are four basic questions which must be answered by every worldview. And these are four concepts which we can use to analyse a worldview. Now, I'm using the titles, as Nancy Piercy does, which are from the Christian worldview, but there's some analogous concept in every worldview, something similar. Piercy actually gives the first three of these, and she's treated the fourth as part of the third. You'll see when I get there. I've chose to put them as four. Four key issues are these. Firstly, creation. Where does it all come from? What's it all about? What is your explanation for the origin of that which exists? Why is there a world? Why is there man, and what is he? With our title tonight, we want to particularly ask, what is the human mind? What is logic, and where does it come from? Why do we treat it as being always valid? Secondly, the fall. What is the basic human problem? What's gone wrong? What's wrong with the world? Non-Christian worldview wouldn't necessarily use the word fall, of course. But we're answering the question, why does bad stuff happen? The human race is in rebellion against God, the Christian worldview answers. And the whole created order, because man was at the centre of that order, has, because of this, come under God's judgment. Man is out of fellowship with God, and under God's sovereign wisdom, this has had cosmic implications. Thirdly, redemption. What is the solution to our basic problem? Where is salvation to come from? How is the wrong to be put right? Creation and man, according to God's word, finds its redemption through the coming into this world and the substitutionary death of the Lord Jesus Christ at Calvary. He is the Redeemer. Creation belongs to him, and he is able to redeem it. And he has now ascended to God's throne and is calling a people out to himself. His righteous life and atoning death deal with our guilt before and need before God. And now we who believe are called together in a new creation, the church. Fourth and finally, we have consummation. And this is the one that I say Piercy is folded into redemption, but I've chosen to separate out. What will the final outcome be? Where is it all headed? How is it all going to end? Christianity answers in the full and final revelation of our Lord Jesus in glory with all his saints, to judge his enemies and glorify his people in a new heavens and new earth. So these are the four questions which can be used to analyse a worldview and really understand where it's coming from. When we compare atheism with theism, we're going to have different things which necessarily exist and which are the backstory behind reality. Different answers to these basic questions. So tonight we're discussing the question, what is logic? How do you know that your reasoning is reliable? Do good and evil really exist, or are they just our personal preferences with nothing ultimately to ground them? Is there objective evil, or just stuff I like and stuff I don't like? On what grounds can we put confidence in scientific method? Is there a grand story behind history which makes it possible to give a coherent explanation? So do you see what the atheist is doing when he is allowed to merely pronounce that he is unbiased and has no presuppositions? He's claiming to not have a worldview, which is impossible. If we don't assume something, we can't build anything on top of it. No foundation, no house. In fact, the atheist does have a worldview. He does have assumptions, and as he reasons and argues, you'll start to find out what they are. He has assumptions about science, assumptions about reason, assumptions about logic. Now, the real question is, can those assumptions be explained by atheism? Can the things which he assumes are be explained by his story about reality? Is atheism a coherent system? Is it internally inconsistent, self-refuting, and ultimately illogical? The entire Christian position can be summed up by a profound phrase spoken by the Apostle Paul in preaching to the court at Mars Hill in Athens. This phrase is so profound. I feel just wow every time it comes into your mind. I think if we begin to grasp it, Acts chapter 17, verse 28. In him we live and move and have our being. In him we live and move and have our being. Authentic Christian thinking must begin, continue, and end with the triune God, because we begin, continue, and end with the triune God. We are created beings. When the atheist asks you to leave behind your worldview, come and sit with him in so-called neutral territory, where we are to merely assume that logic, reason, and so on exist with no explanation needed for them, the atheist is really asking you to think like an atheist. He's asking you to become an atheist before you've begun the debate. Because as Christians, we must insist that these things can only be grounded, coherently explained, in God. So the atheist can't be allowed merely to proclaim himself as neutral and be allowed to use the tools of logic, morality, reason, so forth, as if they existed somewhere in neutral territory. There is no neutral territory. The allowance of neutral territory denies Christianity from the beginning. The Christian claim is that these tools exist within created territory. If you agree to debate on those terms, you're allowing the atheist to stack the deck and deal himself the top five trumps. And sadly, too many Christian apologists are doing that, allowing the atheist to set the terms of the debate. Now, I'm glad that the Christian's hand is still immensely strong, but there's just no need to make life so hard for yourself. And I argue that to allow an atheist to claim part of God's created order as neutral territory is to allow sinful and fallen man to claim for himself that which God has forbidden him to take for himself. If God has created the world, then the tools that exist are God's tools. Logic and reason exist as reflection of the divine order. God is a God of perfect being and proportion and order. There is nothing out of place, nothing chaotic within his being, or even the possibility of it. His being defines perfection, perfect order, and so on. He knows everything perfectly, completely, immediately, and he knows everything in that way in relation to everything else. The existence of laws of logic and the existence of reason in the created world is because this God who I've just spoken about created the created world. The created world reflects the being and the reality of the Creator God. So this talk tonight, in some way, is my creation in some sense, a different sense of course. It reflects the way I'm thinking. You have some kind of access to my inner thoughts and to my mind through these words which I'm speaking to you. Now, much more in the created world, in certain very important things, we have access to the mind of God. The existence of rationality and logic in God's world are from him. Similarly, morality exists in the created world because morality exists within God. He is perfectly, utterly, entirely, and effortlessly good. He is goodness. All that is, and that he loves, that which he loves is good, and all that is contrary to what he is and what he approves is sin. Morality exists in human experience because God's reality and creative work imposes it upon us. It exists in our experience as a revelation of what God is like and what he detests. We are made in the image of God and innately know, without being taught, that there are such things as good and evil. It's impressed upon our being. And we know, without being taught, it's impressed upon our being that good is to be chosen over evil. And God has given us a conscience which witnesses that we ought to choose good, to reject evil, and that if we choose evil, we incur guilt. Now, of course, in this area, we're very much affected by the fall. The image of God has been spoilt, but it still exists within us. It is the basic explanation for why human beings everywhere, including Professor Dawkins, cannot do anything but deal with issues in terms of moral good and moral evil. Why they cannot just say, oh, we don't care about that, let's choose some other way of evaluating human behaviour. It's impressed upon their being. If we go into the atheist worldview, which I'm going to start talking about now, none of these things are so. Nothing can be understood as being imposed upon creation through the being and work of God. Logic and morality have to be an entirely different thing to what we've just said. The atheist then cannot just appeal to them to support his case, because we don't agree on what they are. He must first justify his explanation of what they are. He must give an explanation of what they are, and then he must justify them before he can start using them. But can they? Can he? So really tonight I'm putting the question, is disbelief in divine creation rational? Is unbelief in creation rational? So let's look at some key elements of an atheist worldview. Now what I'm doing here isn't to take the four questions for analysing a worldview, but I'm taking some key elements, the ones which are particularly relevant to what we're talking about tonight. First of all things must be resolved to matter and its properties. It is materialism. Matter is what is held to ultimately exist, and everything else must be explained in terms of matter and its interactions, atoms, molecules, and so forth. There is nothing from outside. There is nothing outside the physical universe. Only the inside of the physical universe exists. That some writers say matter plus energy, but as we understand that those things are convertible, E equals MC squared and so forth, it seems that you don't need to say that. Energy can be resolved into matter. In the atheist worldview, ultimately everything must be explained through matter and its interactions. Now that has an important consequence. And that important consequence is that the human brain, that is the organ in your head, the human brain is entirely sufficient for the human mind. That is, there is no spiritual element to the mind of man. It's completely contained within the brain. There is no soul whose personality and righteousness or sinfulness is expressed through the brain. The brain is not mediating the mind. The brain contains the mind. There is no mind beyond the brain. There is only the mind that is the brain, or contained within the brain, part of the brain. That is a consequence of materialism. Secondly, the universe's organization took place and takes place exclusively through natural and not supernatural processes. Processes of evolution. So, talking here not just about Darwinian evolution, biological evolution, but cosmic evolution, the whole thing. The entire universe in its present form is the result of ongoing, natural, gradual, evolutionary processes and subject to future change. Change is, in the atheist worldview, effectively unlimited. It has brought us everything that we have now. Evolution of one kind or another has brought everything that we have now, so it's effectively unlimited. That's true in Darwinism. Ultimately, in biology, unlimited variation of the species means that there are no species. Darwin called his book The Origin of the Species, but his explanation really is that there are no species. Everything exists in a single family tree. Everything has developed along the lines, the branches and the twigs on that family tree. There are no set fixed boundaries which evolution cannot pass over. It may be for long periods of time we stay in the same place, but there are no boundaries fixed which there cannot be a jump or a more gradual, depending on what kind of evolution you're going for. There's no boundaries that can't be passed over. We're here. Our descendants might be somewhere else completely, just as we've travelled a vast distance from our ancestors. Not many of you look like you dwell in the ocean, so you've come a long way from the atheist point of view. And we could go a long way in the future. So an important consequence to note from that is that the human brain, therefore, itself is the product of evolution and is subject to future ongoing evolution and change. Today, our brains are this way, Yesterday, though, they weren't. And tomorrow, they will be something else. The mind is the result of and undergoing evolutionary change, because remember, the brain contains the mind. Your brain is coded for by your genes, and your brain contains your mind, so your mind ultimately is coded for by your genes and is changing through natural selection, working on random mutations, and so forth. Well, the atheist eschatology, the end, basically there isn't one. Or if there is one, it's just going to be extinction. There's going to be some kind of heat death, and that is for us. The sun will die, human life will end. But ultimately, for the universe as a whole, there isn't one. There's just going to be continuing change, and so there might be just endless continuing change for the human race as well, if we manage to survive the various challenges coming our way. The process of evolution just goes on and goes on and goes on. Now, if you've got access to the internet, or if you can get it from somewhere else, you ought to look up C.S. Lewis's evolutionary hymn, because it's brilliant. I've only got one verse of it here. It's sung to a well-known hymn tune. Lead us, evolution, lead us up the future's endless stair. I would get us all to sing this, but it'd probably be a bit irreverent, I don't know. Choppers, changers, prodders, weeders, for stagnation is despair. Groping, guessing, yet progressing, lead us, nobody knows where. And there's about six or seven verses. It's quite brilliant. So have you got the key points of the atheist worldview? All things must be reduced ultimately to matter and its properties, and all things are subject to change. The key point is there is nothing transcendent. Nothing above and over, greater, nothing coming in from outside. For a Christian, everything ultimately comes in from outside. It's all created. As such, there is no common ground between Christianity and atheism. So now we're in a position to start evaluating whether disbelief in divine creation is rational. How does atheism account for these crucial tools which they seek to use in the fight against God? Well, let's start with the laws of logic themselves. Here I'm talking about such things as the law of non-contradiction. A statement which I make can't both be true and not true. My car can't be both parked back in Belper and not parked back in Belper. I'm talking about things like the law of consequences. If today is Friday, and if Saturday is always the day after Friday, then it follows that tomorrow must be Saturday. There's no other option. They're laws. They can't be changed. And they're universal because they apply anywhere and everywhere. You can't travel somewhere or get into some situation where I can both exist and not exist and so on. Well, Christianity gives us an explanation for these laws. They are, as I've said, a revelation of the order and perfection of the being and mind of God. I live in the world which God has created, and so I am bound by these orders which are imposed by his mind. I am made also in the image of God, and find myself compelled in my everyday toings and froings as much as I can to live by these laws. Now, sometimes I make mistakes in applying them, but I don't have doubts over them. I never think to myself that a thing can both be and not be, or that a statement can be both true and not true. If I believe that my car really is back in Belper, I cannot bring myself to go out this evening to the car park to drive home, because I know that's not going to work out. I don't have to think about it. When I think my car's back in Belper, I then know it's not anywhere else. I am compelled to live that way because I'm made in the image of God. I reflect realities about God in my being. He has imprinted those realities upon my being. An atheist, though, cannot logically take this position. For him, there is nothing transcendent. The universe is a closed system. It's self-sufficient. The laws of logic can only be accounted for within the material universe itself, not through being imposed from outside of it. They must arise from within the universe somehow. They depend upon matter somehow for their existence. But there we have a contradiction. And how can an immaterial law depend upon matter for its existence? If the atheist is willing to grant that the laws of logic are immaterial, which have a hard time not to, and if he grants that they are laws, he's got a problem, which he can't solve. Within the atheist worldview, the laws of logic can only exist within the human mind, which means within the physical brain. In other words, the laws of logic only exist as a product of the physical mechanisms at work within the human brain. That poses enormous problems. Are we now saying that if there were no brains, there would be no logic? Before humans had evolved a few eons ago, was it then possible, because there were no human brains with logic within them, was it then possible for a thing both to exist and not exist, and both to be over here and over there as well? Could a statement both be true and not true? And the Christian says no, because God has always existed, and so such laws which are part of his being are eternal. The atheist, though, has an unanswerable question. How can the atheist even say that there are laws of logic at all? How can there be laws in a non-transcendent universe? Now, typically, the atheist, like Professor Dawkins, he will appeal to repeated observation, scientific method. We test these things a few times, and they always seem to be true, so we make a judgment from statistics that they are true, and we treat them as reliable. All things tested by scientific experiments. The laws of logic, they say, are believed to be true because they've always been true in our observations. And these things are what atheists say when they're questioned about this. I was listening to a debate between a Christian pastor and an atheist, not the one I've already mentioned, and the atheist did take the position that the laws of logic were physical ultimately. When he was questioned about whether those laws existed before humans existed, he then saw he had dug a bit of a hole and he changed his mind, because he hadn't thought about it. He had just assumed that logic was. So we do these experiments and observations, and this is what Dawkins says, but we only have an experience of a small number of logical propositions, and we've only made a limited number of observations. All of those observations are in the past. None of them come from the future. How can we know that they are, in fact, unchanging universal laws? Will it be possible in future for a thing to exist and not exist? Well, we haven't done any experiments on the future because it's not here yet. So the atheist can't say there is a law which prevents a statement both being true and false in the future, because he hasn't done any experiments in the future. Are the laws of logic, in fact, things that only apply in the cases which we've been able to examine? Are there different rules in others? The fact is that this empirical method, the scientific method which Dawkins thinks is the method to discover the entirety of reality, not just things within the realm of science. To Dawkins, the realm of science is the entire realm. But the fact is that empiricism cannot give us universal laws. A Christian scientist can believe that there is a God-given order which exists and is eternal and is waiting to be discovered. An atheist, though, can just describe. He can just describe what he sees today and express his own faith belief that things will continue in that way tomorrow. He can't make a law out of them. So the atheist's common answer to this objection is to say that the laws of logic are ultimately not laws, they are conventions. Well, we get different answers, so I'm giving you some different ones, but this answer is how Professor Gordon Stein argued in that famous debate with Greg Barnson. He said logic is a set of conventions agreed upon by human society. Again, we have the problem of what about when there is no human society. A convention, though, is very different to a law. A convention is subject to change, and it is imposed from below. It's something we've come up with. Whereas a law is something imposed on us, not imposed by us, something which we must yield to. A convention cannot be universal. When those conventions exist only within the human brain, when their origin is in our genes which code for our brain, and when those genes are subject to evolutionary change, what we're effectively saying is there are no laws of logic. The atheist has an unsolvable problem. What if logic evolves in a different direction in future? What if our genes mutate? What if human society determines a new convention, that it will be possible for a thing both to exist and not exist? What if our newly evolved brains determine that the first rule of logic is that God is? The atheist's got a real logical bind here. He wants to use logic, but logic is a fruit and a tool which he's stolen from the Christian worldview. When he uses it, he's stealing from the Christian worldview. He's testifying that the atheistic universe he's trying to build in his mind isn't one that he can actually live in. He's testifying that he's got a self-created atheist universe, but that reality won't allow him to live in it. So, I hope it's very clear what I'm doing here. I'm not questioning the existence of the laws of logic. I'm not suggesting they're false. I'm doing the opposite. I'm saying that they are true. I'm affirming them. But the thing is, I'm saying they can be grounded in my worldview. They cohere with my fundamental assumptions about reality. I can give an account of them and why they are the way they are. The atheist cannot. Well, let's talk about man as a rational being. How can you know that you're a rational being? Our atheist friends are certainly very sure that they're rational beings. They rattle on about it enough. But if man is a rational being, how can he know it? How can he discover that he's rational? What processes can he go through to arrive at the conclusion, yes, I am a rational being. No, I'm not just a monkey who responds to being offered a bit of food. I'm not just a circus animal that's doing some tricks. No, I'm not a crazed loon who ought to be in a room with no doors. How can he know that he hasn't evolved with a brain which, through natural selection, has found it advantageous to make him assume he's rational, even though he isn't? Why can we trust our reasoning processes? As a Christian, I answer that man is made in the image of God, and God has revealed a knowledge of himself to man in the act of creating him. It is self-evident that man has a generally reliable faculty of reason, because God has, in creating human nature, impressed this truth upon it. It is essential to it, this testimony that it is so. Now, someone's going to say, that's circular reasoning. It is circular reasoning, but that's my point. All worldviews must cut the knot somehow. Some things have to be started with. If we start by knowing nothing, we can only end up knowing nothing. The point is that the Christian worldview gives a coherent account. It all hangs together. It's self-consistent. It explains itself. Worldviews can only win out by competing with each other. You can't just do what's done in biology of Darwinism, and the Darwinists say, well, our system explains stuff, therefore it's true. Well, maybe some other system explains stuff as well. Maybe it explains stuff better than your system. Worldviews have to compete. And when the Christian worldview competes with the atheistic one, it wins. How can the atheist know that he's rational? Whether he's rational or not, how can he know it? His brain is the result of continuing evolutionary change. It's subject to future evolutionary change. If humanity is rational today, how will we know it's rational tomorrow? We might observe ourselves to be reasoning creatures today, but what necessity is there we should be so in the future? Rationality in the atheist worldview is an evolved trait. Nettles, artichokes, and cabbages are not rational, as man is rational. Yet, according to the atheist, we have a common ancestor with them. How is it that we can know that the stage that we arrive at today is rationality? It seems obvious to us that we are rational, that is, that we reason, and that we are fundamentally reasoning beings, and Christianity gives a good account of why it is so. But atheism can't explain it. He has to take a leap in the dark, a leap of faith. So Richard Dawkins merely assumes that he is rational. He behaves like it's handed down from heaven on a plate. He says, I have a working faculty of reason. Now let me use that working faculty of reason to fight against Christianity. But we've got to say, hang on there. As you seem to do, do believe, if you like, that the rationality you have was handed down from heaven on a plate and can be relied upon. But you don't. You don't believe that. Professor Dawkins needs to give an account for his belief in his own rationality. What he's doing instead is two things in particular. Firstly, he's giving a clear testimony that he is made in the image of God, because the tools he seeks to use in his war are God-given ones. He's a man and must behave like a man. He must testify that he does know of the true God. Secondly, he's stealing the tools of the Christian worldview to fight against it. He's acting as if the most important arena in which to fight Christianity is the world of ideas, using the tools supplied by rationality. In doing so, he's not being true to his own atheistic assumptions. It would be rather more efficient for Professor Dawkins simply to shoot the people he disagreed with, rather than spend time trying to persuade them and reason them. Writing books, television programs, very lengthy, costly, requires hard work. Which brings us on to the third issue. Now, if that one wasn't so clear, I think this one would be the clearest. The existence of good and evil, or morality. We have the question of good and evil, of right and wrong, the existence of morality itself. So Richard Dawkins uses this heavily in his book. According to him, the God described by the Old Testament is a rather terrible creature. And I didn't find time to get the exact quote, but it's, you know, it's quite a masterful use of the English language, a whole string of colourful words strung together to insult this being found in the pages of the Old Testament. Arguments based on the problems of good and evil, they're a staple of atheist apologetics. Why does a good God allow evil things to happen? Why is there so much suffering in the world if there is a God desiring good for us? If he can stop the pain and doesn't, then he can't be good after all. So the Christian God cannot exist, and so on. But again, we cannot let the atheist jump in at that point. We need to wind back a bit. What are good and evil from the Christian point of view? Good, as we have said, is a revelation of the righteous character of God. Moral evil is that which is opposed to the righteous character of God. For us, there are binding moral absolutes, because we are created by God and we live in his world. We know ourselves to be moral beings, and we are morally constrained because we're made in God's image. God has written these facts upon our created nature. He is a moral being, we are made in his image, and so we are moral beings. My goldfish are not morally accountable beings, but I am. Remember, though, that in the atheist world, nothing can be imposed from outside. Morality must have a different explanation. The atheist who just leaps into the discussion of whether religion promotes evil, he's sparing himself a lot of hard and necessary work. So some atheists will say that good and evil are a matter of personal choice. Now, that doesn't get you very far. You define your own good and evil. You choose what's right and wrong for you. That doesn't get you very far, though. Can I choose that it's right for me to shoot you? Can I choose that it's right for me to steal your car or your wife, please, Mr. Atheist? And he'll say no. So generally they'll advance, or they'll maybe start with a position that morality is a matter of consensus and culture, that society decides. But it's not down to the individual, but in some sense transcends him, because society transcends him. Society agrees on what's acceptable, and individuals live within this structure. That is still ultimately a matter of personal choice. It's just more persons who are making the choice. This also relativizes good and evil. This justifies 9/11 and the horrors of the concentration camps of Auschwitz and Belsen. Nazi society defined the killing of Jews, gypsies and so on by consensus as good. By consensus, they were part of an inferior race, and by consensus, they must be exterminated as efficiently as possible for the good of society as a whole. Nazi society put the atheist definition of morality, ignoring anything imposed by God from above and just deciding on a new consensus, into practice. They adopted the cultural consensus that the Aryan race, so-called, was inherently superior, and it would be good to empty the world of certain inferior races, which they define by consensus. Is that where the atheist wants to stand? The one atheist who I listened to in a debate with Pastor Gene Cook, you can download this one for free on the internet, Gene, G-E-N-E, Cook. He answered this objection by saying that Germany's actions were immoral in the light of Western civilization taken as a whole. So we expand the circle a bit more. It's not just society within Germany, but you've got to go back over the years of Western civilization and the West take a larger territory. And then we overrule Nazi Germany by saying that what they did was wrong. Now this is just pretty arbitrary. Why just stop at Western civilization? Why not expand it to take the whole world? So now when we have to decide whether anything is good or evil, we have to take a poll of every living human being to find out whether they think it's good or evil, and then we'll find the consensus. Now, you cannot live your life that way. That ultimately means we can never decide what good and evil are. I might just not have asked enough people if I've discovered that my actions are good. I might just need to ask a few more, and then I'll find that actually it's evil. How can I live this way? If I need to trawl the history books or ask an entire civilization, how can I work out if I'm right or wrong? See, these atheist arguments are so poor, they can't even say whether the Holocaust was right or wrong. Arguments of this kind are hoisting the atheist on his own petard. Western civilization has traditionally looked where for its source of morality? To God, to the revelation of Christianity. The majority belief throughout the cultures of the world is that atheism is immoral. It has been so throughout history and is still so in the world today. Does the atheist believe that atheism is immoral if he decides to live for a little while, for work or whatever, in Saudi Arabia? Let's go and move into a Muslim country and let's have historic Islamic culture being the consensus which determines whether action is good or evil. According to that civilization you've now moved into, atheism is evil. Do you agree, Mr. Atheist? Atheists are no more than 8% of the world population, according to the research website adherence.com. Is the atheist now going to concede that atheism itself is immoral? Or at least for those born into a Muslim society, it's immoral? Another atheist response is to say that morality is a question of what best advantages the species for future survival. What's in the best interest of preserving our genes? But when you do this and make morality just a matter of whether it leads to more of us or less of us, it's really no longer morality. It's just pragmatic. It's just what works out best. It's not a moral imperative. You ought not to do this because it's wrong. It's just a pragmatic imperative. You ought not to do this because it's not a good long-term strategy. It's a matter of speculative judgment. In my opinion, the long-term outcome of this decision will be such and such. But I can't actually find out if the action was good or evil until its effects have been worked out over the succeeding lines of genes and generations, by which time I'll be long dead. There's no basis in there for deciding whether an action is good or evil if you have to find out whether your genes or the genes of the whole society survive or not through it. But if morality is just a matter of survival, we've just wiped out whole classes of sins. If I commit massive fraud and cause my hypothetical business to fail, I'll go to jail and I'll get 3 square meals a day. But it's not going to kill me or anybody else. Is massive fraud no longer evil? Or is it only evil when there's no jail system to house the people who did it? Or it's not evil, why are we putting them in jail anyway? Again, do we have to wait 100 years to see what the long-term effects are before we announce a verdict? In fact, this test doesn't even deal with the most obvious sins. Humanity has survived for thousands of years with an ongoing low level of murder and rape and other such crimes. We've survived that ongoing low level of such terrible things. Does this mean that they're not immoral after all because the species survives? And so the atheist might say, well, if everybody indulged in them, it would be ruinous. So you've got to make that the test. The species is threatened if everybody does them. Well, 4 things in reply to that. It's false. Rape doesn't necessarily threaten the species' survival. Or with murder, let's only choose to murder elderly ladies in care homes. Let's only choose to murder those who can no longer reproduce, or the senile, or the weak, or the infirm. This is coming into Nazi theology again, isn't it? I think we can be pretty confident that if we only wipe out old ladies in care homes, then the human race will survive pretty much the same. Secondly, it's the thin end of the wedge fallacy. Lots of things are harmful if you do them to excess, but we're perfectly able to survive them in small doses, like drinking coffee. Too much coffee and you'll die. Does that mean that drinking coffee is evil? Thirdly, it confuses the distinction between morality and wisdom. Suppose I make a bad business decision and it ruins my company. Same effect as if I committed fraud. So are they the same in terms of good and evil? Are they the same level of morality? And a foolish decision or deliberate fraud both have the same effect. If you're just measuring it in terms of effect, how can you distinguish? So fourthly, it's a very limited basis for morality. Whole clusters of things that atheists would agree were evil don't threaten the species' survival, and some might even promote it. A woman has an infertile husband. She can't pass on her genes if she's faithful. What is good and evil from the atheist point of view for the woman with an infertile husband if it's all about species survival? So what we're discovering here is that atheism is only descriptive and not prescriptive. That is, it can only describe what things are and can never say what things ought to be. There can be no ought with atheism. Atheists can only express his personal preferences. They can never be a guide for someone else. This is the logical outworking of the denial of creation. If morality is just a matter of culture, culture is produced by human brains. Human brains come from genes. There can never be an ought. If morality is just a question of survival, it's just a question of tactics and strategy. Why then doesn't the atheist accept these things as the logical outworking of his worldview? If he wants to live rationally and consistently, why does he not just affirm these things which logic and reason require of him? The answer is that the atheist does not have the option of living in the fantasy world which he's constructed. He can only live, ultimately, in the real world which God has created. He's made in the image of God. The pressure from his created nature is too great. The man who affirms that there is no real evil and then puts that belief into practice will soon be carted off and locked up. So what about the so-called problem of evil? The atheist concludes that there is no God because of the problem which evil poses. However, the atheist's solution implies that there is no evil, only personal preferences. The atheist, to be consistent, ought to go to the grieving mother who's lost her baby or the victim of a natural disaster in his problem of evil and tell them that they're being irrational. Evolution has ensured that life survived hundreds of millions of years so far and will do so in the future too. Beings live and die every day. Death is to be celebrated, not mourned, because the next generation is inevitably going to be more highly evolved than the present one. This is the atheist's problem of evil. The logic of his position is there is no evil. It's a mere projection of human thought, has no cosmic reality behind it. Millions died under the Nazis. Millions of bacteria die when the bug spray is got out. What's the difference? One took one route on the evolutionary tree, another took another route on the evolutionary tree. Your opinion that one is more valuable than the other is just your opinion. You choose to call the death of millions in the Nazi concentration camps evil. I choose to call that good, and the death of millions of bacteria evil. How can you say I'm wrong? Well, let's pass on. Oh, well, there you have it. The atheist problem of evil. There is no evil. Why are you getting worked up about September 11th anyway? Atheism and coherence. Very briefly, think about those three things which we've mentioned put together: logic, reason, and morality. Do they agree with each other? Atheists seem to think that they do agree because they use all three of them in their arguments. But how can they account for that agreement? What if what is logical is immoral? The Christian does not have to lie at night worrying whether logic will require him to be immoral or such things, because the character of God has no contradictions. All these things meet together perfectly in the character of the triune God. Logic cannot lead us into wickedness. What is sinful can never be necessary for us. These things cannot be, whilst the character of God is. That's why divine creation is so essential for rationality and morality. Creation is undergirding these things. In him we live and move and have our being. God's world, orderly, rational, logical and moral. Purpose of life. Purpose of life. Why do anything? Does life have meaning? The earth is nothing compared to the vast dimensions of space. It's hardly anything compared to the dimensions of our one galaxy, let alone the trillions of galaxies taken all together. Compared to the size of the universe, it is smaller than the tiniest subatomic particle is compared to you. It's a nothing. So what is the meaning of all that happens upon the earth? That being so, Professor Dawkins is getting very hot under the collar in his atheist crusade. But why, if he was right, would it matter? He's talking about the beliefs of a few short-lived specks of dust, all living on a speck of dust, smaller than a speck of dust, that's nothing in the vast dimensions of the atheist universe. So some atheists have faced this frankly and confessed that in their view there is no ultimate meaning. Dawkins has written, "The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." You see that? No purpose, no design, just pitiless indifference, no evil and no good. Well, he didn't tell you when he was giving all those arguments in the God delusion about how religion was evil, that in his worldview there is no evil. It's hard to be a consistent atheist. Now, have you heard the atheist say something like the following response? It says, "There is no ultimate cosmic meaning, so we've got to invest our brief lives with as much meaning as we can. We're the only ones who can give our existence meaning, not God, so we're encouraged as much as possible to make life meaningful rather than to despair." Now, that frankly is the very heart of irrationality. If there is no meaning, there is no meaning. Your attempt to live under the meaning delusion is irrational. You are indulging in the atheist delusion. You're trying to construct and live in a reality which is contrary to the facts as you claim they are. Well, that's fine, go ahead and do it. Just don't accuse Christians of being irrational. Professor Dawkins supposes that somebody will say, you know, these Christians and other religious people, they get a lot out of their religion, so why don't we just leave them alone to be happy? And he says in answer that we ought to face the truth. We ought as humans to be concerned about truth. Fine, apply that idea to atheism. Let's not pretend that our efforts to invest life with meaning are rational. Let's expose that they're false and abandon them. Let's not live as if Christianity were true and that there were meaning. And we must not let the atheist again steal our tools and the fruits of our belief. So the only rational outcome of the atheist worldview is despair. No meaning, no future, no hope. Only extinction or endless change. Atheists need to face up to the logic of their position. If they don't, and they continue to argue that we can live as if life did have meaning, we're going to have to keep pointing out that they're being irrational. So in conclusion, let's say this. The atheist, in debating with the creationist, says he wants you to leave your assumptions and come onto some neutral ground. However, if you look at the ground he's actually inviting you onto, you'll find it's not neutral. He's seeking to take the reality of morality, logic and so on as if they were neutral, but these are the very things which atheism cannot explain or justify. The tools he's seeking to use are stolen. There is no neutral ground. The whole creation is God's. It's creation and creation alone that gives coherence and meaning to science. We can go to work to explore God's creation using God's tools. We can believe that there is a divine order imposed on the world and go out to study it. Atheistic science just hangs in midair. It uses tools which it cannot give any coherent account for. No wonder they're trying to redefine them as neutral and hope we won't notice rather than explaining them. The creationist can live without a split personality. He sees a perfect coherence of truth, morality, logic and so on because of their shared origin in God, the Creator. Truth cannot be immoral, evil cannot be logical. The creation, it sees that all things hold together in him. There's no conflict. Atheism as a system of thought floats in midair. The atheist, as a living person, continually behaves as if he can take truth and logic and morality for granted. But by doing so, he gives plain evidences that he is created in the divine image, knows God, and is sinfully resisting that knowledge. Atheism cannot explain the world that really is. Christianity can explain atheism. Its explanation is in Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. Paul explains that all people everywhere know God. They know that he is and that he is God. They've had it revealed to them and in them. All people everywhere are made by God in his image. We share things in common with God. We reflect him in various essential ways. Now suppose I have a photograph of my wife. It's not my wife. It's distinct from her. There's a vast gap between it and my wife. However, in some ways it reflects definite realities about my wife. Human beings are essentially made in the image of God and reflect, whether they like it or not, realities about God. The atheist knows this and seeks to suppress it. The truth keeps imposing itself upon him and he fights against it. He deliberately chooses to seek to empty his mind of such truths and desires to fill it with other thoughts. He willfully rejects God and chooses folly. Let me read to you Romans chapter 1, verse 18 to 23. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because of what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. The atheist knows God, his eternal power and deity, but seeks to suppress it. This can't be done once and for all, though, because he is made in God's image and reality keeps leaping up on him. As much as he hates the one whose image he bears, he still bears it. Atheists cannot help themselves from continually lapsing into talking like theists. The truth keeps leaking out. It's ingrained in their nature and reveals itself constantly. He speaks about truth, about good, about evil, about meaning and purpose in life, takes the existence of reason and logic for granted, seeks to use them, but he cannot give any ultimate explanation for them. Professor Dawkins gets hot under the collar about the evil caused by religion, even though in his own universe evil has no meaning. Professor Dawkins talks like a Christian, uses Christian ideas, and does so whilst fighting Christianity at the same time. The way in which Professor Dawkins chooses to express his rebellion clearly demonstrates that he knows God. It has been well said that the atheist creed has two fundamental statements. Number one, there is no God. Number two, I hate him. I once heard about an incident in a mental home in the United States. The residents all had a form of brain damage and they were unable to pass spoken language. Many of them, though, had compensated for it by developing an extraordinary ability to interpret body language. On this particular day, they were watching their television and President Bill Clinton was addressing the nation and he was speaking about some of the things surrounding the Lewinsky affair. The mental home residents couldn't understand his words, but they did break out into uproarious laughter. His body language seemed to them to be hilarious. The clear message which they had perceived was that the words from his lips and what he knew to be true were in total discord, and the result to them was amusing as they interpreted his body language as he struggled to convince others of what he knew wasn't true. That's what happens to the Christian who's fought through the issues we've been discussing today. That is, Christian who's sitting in his chair watching. He hears the atheist speak. The words deny that God is. The assumptions behind the words at every level affirm that God is. There's a complete disconnect. He's trying to construct a building which denies God, but the foundations on which he builds it affirm God. His position is unreasonable, irrational, and illogical to the highest degree. Man is made in the image of God. Man cannot deny his fundamental nature. It keeps leaking out. He's created. He lives in the created world. He's compelled to keep on contradicting the beliefs he claims to hold. He's irrational. What we've been talking about tonight is sometimes described as the termed the transcendental proof. Transcendental proof for the existence of God. That proof is that unless we adopt belief in the Christian God, revealed by Scripture, as the essential assumption, unless we adopt belief in the triune God as our essential presupposition, we cannot prove anything else at all. Unless we assume the reality of divine creation, we cannot go on to make any further discoveries. God's reality is established by the impossibility of assuming anything to the contrary. The wonderful message of Christianity is that this God, whose truth is so wickedly suppressed, took on human form, came into the world. The one in whom we live and move and have our being became a man like us, was damned in the place of sinful men and women, truth denying, truth suppressing, God hating men and women. God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. Whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. The God who is infinitely merciful and offers not just a coherent worldview, but eternal life, knowing him through his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. May all the glory go to his name.